Well, that's a real special treat from back home right there, to get to lead some thoughts after the boy leads some singing. The man, look at him, he's huge. Well, we find ourselves here at the last night of our gospel meeting together, and it's a bittersweet moment because it's been a terrific week, but it is a little bit bitter because I got to go home. I've got things I've got to do back home with the church at the Expressway, and you all have got work that you've got to do here and continue on without us with you. And I just got to tell you, I am tremendously satisfied that you are in great hands. We spent a week with Keith and Rita, and I'm going to tell you, he is not your common preacher, and she is not your common preacher's wife. What you all have here is pure gold. Their hearts are yours. You be careful with them. The labor that they engage is hard labor. And they do it all hours of the day and night. They're dedicated to the truth. And they're absolutely committed to helping you get to heaven. And they're more than that. They're interested in helping your families and your friends and the people of this community get to heaven. And they are more than capable. We're so thankful for their hospitality. It's been an incredible week. I feel like we've made good friends, new friends, and thrilled to have been able to stay with them. And I just don't know I could have had it any other way. We're so thankful for them. They put up with my foolishness till 3 a.m. Tuesday morning. Now, you hear that? Till 3 a.m. They set me a bedtime the rest of the week and told me to go on. But they put up with it. And I think that's the important part. I love them. Love them. Just come to really appreciate them this week. And I know you all must. So you do the work that you do together. And you hold their hands up. And you do it with smiles together. And you'll find that the miles will pass beneath you. And it will all have seemed as nothing when you get to the end of the road. You'll be glad you did. Well, I was fed all day today. Just people kept stuffing food in my mouth. First it was with the Greers at home. Then it was with Grellaford's at lunch. And then it was with the Sims at dinner. Jeannie Sims owes me a big one. And I don't mean like a debt. He owes me, you'd ask him what he owes me. And I'll tell you, every time I see Jeannie, I'm looking over my shoulder for a couple months, wondering what's going to come after me, because he's been holding something against me a long time, and he's right to have done so. Now, I was told to talk up real loud to make sure Jennifer stays awake tonight. It's been a great week. I'm so thankful to see you all, and I'll tell you, I'm really honored to get to introduce you to my kids. These two people are the light of our lives, and we just love them, and we think they're special. And I just don't know what to tell them but to say a lot of these people are what made me what I am. And so it's their fault. Okay, let's go to 1 Kings 12. Let's talk a little bit about a man named Rehoboam and another man named Jeroboam. We're going to look here, and our final look here, at an Old Testament story that teaches us some lessons that should help us live in the world in which we are currently finding ourselves. The difficulties that come with being people haven't changed over thousands of years of humanity. And you'll find that God has given us all the tools that we need to manage the life that He's given us in a way that is both effective and productive. And what we talked about in the previous few nights were the ancestors of Jeroboam. We talked about David, who was a tremendous king, and his son, Solomon, who was an amazing king. But both of those men made some pretty terrible mistakes. And although Solomon was the wisest man who had ever lived, some of the mistakes he makes bear the marks of short-sightedness. He wasn't looking far enough into the future. And as we look at the end of chapter 11, you see here in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, the things he said, they're said about him in the earlier part of the chapter, that he set up altars for his foreign wives to worship the abomination of the Ammonites. and the Moabites and some of these terrible otherites that there were, that Solomon opens a door for idolatry in a way that only Jeroboam will really be able to take advantage of. Jeroboam couldn't have started things the way that Solomon did. But Solomon gets these things rolling. Now, if you go through the rest of chapter 11, it's very clear that God is so displeased with Solomon that he's not going to let his son Rehoboam reign over the entire kingdom. That he's going to tear it away, as has been prophesied, from him. He'll keep some. He'll keep these southern two tribes. But the northern ten will tear away, and they will have another king. A man that God prophesied directly to named Jeroboam. Jeroboam, who was a thorn in the side of Solomon. And it was so much so that Solomon wanted to kill him and sent men to do it. And if you've ever heard of Benaiah, and if you don't know anything about Benaiah, look him up when you get home. It's fascinating reading. If Benaiah is on your track, you're in a whole lot of trouble, because that guy always gets his man. But Jeroboam flees and goes all the way to Egypt. And after he hears that Solomon has died, he comes back. And maybe, just maybe, things can be the way they want them to be without Solomon on the throne anymore. Maybe, just maybe, since Rehoboam's going to take over, they can see a change in the way the kingdom is run. So we'll begin in chapter 12, and we'll start at verse 1. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard it — he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt — that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us, and we will serve you." So he said to them, "Depart for 3 days, then come back to me." And the people departed. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon when he still lived, and he said, "How do you advise me to answer these people?" And they spoke to him, saying, "If you'll be a servant to these people today, and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever." But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him, and consulted with the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. And he said to them, "What advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke which your father put on us'?" Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you should speak to this people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, that you make it lighter on us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. And now, whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges.'" So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king had directed, saying, "Come back to me the third day." Then the king answered the people roughly and rejected the advice which the elders had given him. He spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I'll add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I'll chastise you with scourges." So the king did not listen to the people, for the turn of events was from the Lord, that he might fulfill his word which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. So you got a situation here that is a huge contrast. You got a man who's becoming king. Now again, last night when we talked about Solomon, the Queen of Sheba said, "Blessed are the servants who are in the court of Solomon," because they're listening to the wisdom of Solomon every day, all day long. That's like going to college for free. This is the most brilliant man of their time or any other. So what do you think it would be like to be Solomon's son? How much wisdom could a fella absorb at home with a dad like that? Well, if you had a dad like that who had 1,000 wives and women, you probably didn't see him much, I'll just be honest with you. And what we see is that he doesn't seem to have picked up much of that wisdom. In fact, he seems to be kind of dumb. And he asked advice from two different groups of people. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But I want you to see the advice. He first goes to older men. It's a good idea. If you're a young man, old men have stuff that you don't have and you need it. Then he asked his pals. He asked his buddies. He asked the crew he's been running with, his gang. Very different answers. And so what does he do? He takes the advice of the younger men. What happens next is that the kingdom tears away from him. And the people say that everybody should go to their tents. They're going to make this removal happen. And they start separating themselves, and they're going to have their own country, and they want their own king, and Rehoboam is going to get ready to fight with them. It's about to be a civil war. See that in verse 19. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Even upon the writing of this, still what's happened. So you go down a little bit further here, and what you'll see is that God told Rehoboam not to fight against his own people. And so they tabled that. But I want you to see what happens next. Because Rehoboam's not the only person who doesn't get wisdom and take it and make the most of it. There's another problem beginning down here in verse 25. Then Jeroboam, this is the other guy, remember, who's going to take the 10 tribes in the north. He built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. Also, he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord of Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore, the king asks advice. You ever noticed that before? Doesn't specify who he asked advice from, but it does say he asked advice. Boy, I've gone through this passage 1,000 times and never noticed that little phrase. Then he asks advice, and what does he do after he gets advice? He makes 2 calves of gold and said to the people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. He made shrines in high places and priests from every class of people who are not of the sons of Levi. That's a tremendous error, a grave sin against the law that was given by Moses. Verse 32, Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing the calves that he had made. And at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. Well, we find ourselves in a conundrum with these two texts. After watching his father be wise and be unwise, Rehoboam has 2 wisdom opportunities. Did you know that you could do that? Did you know you could learn from the good example of somebody and from their bad example both? Did you know that? Did you know people are doing the same thing with you? And you have an opportunity living in the world where you are to compare what people are doing to the results they're getting and compare what people are doing to what God says and see on 2 different planes there's wisdom and then there's spiritual wisdom. And you need to consider what those people are doing. Do you want the trouble that Solomon had? Well, then you better not make the dumb mistakes that Solomon made. And he has the opportunity to learn that, but he does not. He also has the opportunity to learn from the law of which he is supposed to have a copy. And he doesn't do that. Instead, what he does is he decides he needs to make his own mark. Do you see the language that he's using up here? that his friends advise him to use. He compares himself to Solomon. Solomon, who was staggeringly rich, amazingly wise. So what's he want to do? Oh, you just never mind about Solomon. My little finger is going to be thicker than his waist. You thought it was rough under him. Let me tell you, buddy, it's about to get 10 times rougher. I'm the real deal, don't you know? He has to distinguish himself. Why? His ego. He needs to be seen. He needs to be identified. He doesn't want to be Solomon's son. He wants to be real. He wants people to say his name with reverence, fear. He doesn't want to be known as just one more king in a line. He wants to be known as the king with the iron fist. And he's got to have it his way. He's got to make his own mark. And this is frequently a mistake that young people make. They use self-will to destroy themselves. The hubris of youth sometimes is described like this. In the pursuit of something that you think looks like greatness or importance or prominence, you end up burning up the resources and the abilities that you have, and you end up with regrets and debts, problems, issues, conflicts. As long as those things remain unresolved and undealt with, they get worse and worse and worse. Why? Because somewhere along the way, you had to have your way. You had to have what you wanted. You had to have it just the way it felt or seemed right to you. And notice that's what both of these guys have done. They've decided they're going to have it their way. And so here in this book, in chapter 12, from about verse 25 onward, you have what I like to describe as the first denominations, where somebody takes what was the Lord's originally and they pervert it by adding a couple of different things that they suited them a little bit better. And all of the explanation is right there for you. Why does Jeroboam set up the things that he does? The golden calves? Why does he set them up in Dan? Why does he set them up in Bethel? Why does he do that? Well, it says all over the place. The things he had made, the things he had devised in his heart. And it even reveals for us the reasoning that he uses. He says, I like this business about being the new king. I like this whole 10 tribes being mine up here. And the problem is, folks are still going to want to do what God tells them to do. And at least 3 times a year, they have to go back to Jerusalem to offer certain sacrifices and participate in special feast days. Why Jerusalem? Because it is the place that the Lord our God has commanded, which is all the way back in the law, even before it's Jerusalem. He says, in the place which the Lord designates. And he says to himself, self, if the people go back and see the sights of the temple and hear the sounds of the singing and the horns and smell the smells of the sacrifices and the incense that's burning, if they feel the embrace of their brethren all around them, if they taste the foods that are there in Jerusalem, they will be brought in their hearts back to Rehoboam. You see what the problem is? Those people's senses would draw them back in and connect all of the good things about being in Jerusalem to why they should be in Jerusalem. And he says, well, we can't have that now, can we? We can't have people listening to the truth and hearing that. What we need to do is spectacle! Woo! Golden calves! And they're up here in the north! And they're down here in the south! And don't you make one more step! You don't have to go all the way to Jerusalem. That's so right now. You can go all the way up there if you need to go up there. You can come all the way up there. And I'm going to tell you, you're going to see a beautiful golden calf. You're going to have your sacrifice up here. It's all on fire! Woo! It's going to be great! Meanwhile, it's just a common thing to understand. The law says you should come down here. Come to Jerusalem. He says, oh, I got something more exciting for you up here, guys. Look, these are the gods brought you out of Egypt. Starts lying to him immediately. But he does it to get what he wants. Now, friends, I don't know how to draw any clearer lines than these to make it abundantly obvious. This is exactly how denominations start. And it doesn't start with some crazy, stark contrast where people leave one group that's doing 10 things and they go off and do 10 totally different things. No, no. They do 9 of those 10 things and they do 1 different thing. And they do that because they want it to be that way. They like this better. You see, denominations frequently start from local church divisions. Somebody has to have something that they want that they're not getting with the church. And rather than talk about it and study this book together and say, well, what do the scriptures actually teach? I might be wrong, you might be wrong, we might both be wrong, but I know what's right. Rather than just sit down and do that, people just take off, get what they want, do what they want, have what they want, all based on self-will. Selfishness, ego, pride, all of these things are the enemy of truth. All of these things are the enemy of righteousness. So, I got a question for you. In a world where there's a thing called the selfie, are people going to have trouble with self-will? There are a thousand selfies uploaded to Instagram every second of every day. There's about a total of 93 million selfies taken every day in the world as of 2016. In 2015, more people died taking selfies in dangerous places than died from shark attacks globally. What? Those are facts. Look them up. So in a world that seems to be obsessed with a are we going to have trouble with self-will? Is there going to be a generation of people who have raised themselves to say, I'm the most important thing in my life? Look at all the beautiful pictures of me. There are literally thousands of them on my phone and on my Snapchat and on my Instagram and on my Facebook. It used to be, if you really wanted to see a lot of pictures of somebody, go to grandma's house and they'll show you more pictures of that kid than you'd ever want to see. But now, the kid provides their own pictures. Now listen to me, this all may sound really silly to you, but I want you to extrapolate the mindset that goes along with an obsession over being pictured by yourself, to yourself, for yourself. What is that doing to the mentality of humans? It's feeding them the same line that the devil's been feeding people for just thousands of years. Your opinion matters more than anybody else's. What you want is more important than what he wants. What you need outranks what she needs. And if you're not getting your way, figure out a way to get it. Weasel, steal, cajole, persuade, provoke, threaten, or otherwise force your way on other people. Do you think that that's a reasonable extrapolation? Well, I'm going to give you a little test you can do. The next time you see somebody taking 10 photos of themselves, offer them a little critique, just anything. Something about the way they look, or the way that they're standing, or the you know, just something critical. And don't make it like, you know, pink's not your color, try something darker. I mean, something critical, something that says, you don't really look good in those pictures, or, you know, it's your mouth is kind of big, isn't it? Shouldn't you shut it when you take a picture like that? Your eyebrows are crooked. One is higher than the other. Should you? You do that, and I'm going to tell you what you're going to hear. Exasperation, snotty little sigh, a baby a little something like, rude. Because people who are obsessed with selfies cannot be critiqued. They've been trained by parents, by society, by themselves, to be impervious to you. Because they need what they want. And they'll have it. And you just don't know what you're doing. You know what you're talking about. You might end up with a... Have you looked at yourself? Oh yeah. To criticize a man. You might get one of those. But critique is not something a generation of people who take 93 million pictures of themselves a day, critique is not something they can take. Constructive criticism is not something on the menu. And I'm going to tell you something, folks, if you don't help your grandkids, and you don't help your friends and their neighbors and their kids, if you don't help people get used to the idea that the center of the universe is not revolving around them, a whole generation of people will be lost. Because the world will be taken away from them while they're posing. Self-will creates an awful lot of problems. God's people are called. Philippians, the second chapter, verses 3 and 4, makes it crystal clear. We're to look out for one another. We're supposed to look out for the interests of other people. We're supposed to put what they need above ourselves. And verse 5 says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, didn't consider a robbery to be considered equal with God. He made himself of no reputation and took on the form of a servant. If Jesus could be a servant, we can be servants. And that will distinguish us. And let me just suggest to you, brethren, that may be one of the most important evangelistic tips I could give you for the next 30 years. If you learn to be a servant, you'll get the attention of people because you'll be so different from everybody else. And gaining entrance into people's lives by serving them out of love may open a door for the gospel in that same life. And it's just hard to tell what might happen. Well, let's talk about getting advice for just a second. I read something not too long ago, and we shared that with several folks in different Bible classes. There's a theory, and I think it's absolutely true, that you equal the five people that you associate the most with. That you are drastically influenced. You are very much informed by the five people. So everybody, I see everybody doing this number. They're like, oh, this is and then right here, and then around about this number or this number, people go, oh, because there's somebody you spent a lot of time with that they don't want to be like, right? Well, who is it that you're getting your advice from? Twice in this text, two men who have an amazing responsibility placed on their shoulders take bad advice and make horrible mistakes because of it. So, from where is your advice coming? I tell young people this all the time, and I think if you've got kids or grandkids, you need to tell them this too. Why do you take advice from your peers? If you are 17 years old, why would you ask another 17-year-old for advice? What do they know that you don't know? And I'll tell you the number one thing that young people say. When I say, what does the 17-year-old friend of yours know that makes them so useful for you? And they say, they know me. Wait a second. Are we back in self-will again? That's exactly where we're at. The reason they ask advice is because, well, they know me. You don't need advice from people who know you. You need advice from people who know stuff. You need advice from people who know things, who've been other places, who've had experiences that you haven't, who know things you've not learned yet. Advice and counsel is meant to be something externally obtained to help you in an internal way. And it's not just young people. It's old people too. It's middle-aged people as well. Rather than find the best source of information for what they need, they find the place that's handiest. And unfortunately, before we get too hard on young people, let's be honest, all people do this on social media. You get to build a profile for yourself and only select the people that you want to hear from. You don't have to be friends with people who disagree with you politically. You don't have to be friends with people that you disagree with morally. You don't have to be friends with people that are not like you. And most of the time, and I mean this, when I say most, I mean this time, about 99.9% of the time, that's exactly the way we've all set it up. People who say things we don't agree with, people who say things we find offensive, people who say things that we wouldn't say, we defriend them, or we block them, or we never friend them at all. And so what happens is we create a little echo chamber for ourselves. So when we start talking about things and we float something out on social media and we say, X, Y, Z, political views, spiritual thought, we get a series of comments from people who say, you go, girl, that's the truth, don't you know it, absolutely, thumbs up, emoji, smiley, blah, 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 blah. And most of us have it set up that we don't get a negative comment from someone who says, have you considered the other point of view from what you're saying, because there's some merit to this idea as well. Most of us don't have friends like that on social media. And most of us, the reason we have it that way is because we don't want friends like that on social media. We like to be reinforced. We like to be affirmed. We want things to be the way we think they are. And so we live in a fantasy realm where we've created a world like we're God, and all the people there agree with us. And at the end of the day, I can turn off my computer or my tablet or my phone, and I can know that all is well on Phil's Island. But that's not real. That's not actually happening. There's a dark world out there. There's a lot of terrible stuff that continues to happen. So I'm going to ask you to consider something with me. This is relevant in the realm of evangelism, of soul saving. Most of us are interested in saving people in a homogeneous way. You know what that means? People like us. We look for people who are morally virtuous, people who are religiously inclined, people who don't use bad language, people who aren't painted up like they fell off of a circus wagon, people who aren't pierced through as if they have shrapnel for more and there's bits and pieces hanging all over them. We're looking for people whose hair is the color God made it, not some imaginary color from the Wizard of Oz, like the horse of many, or the horse of a different color. Most of us are looking for somebody who's not us yet, but with a little bit of work, they could be just like us. That's what we're looking for. And so I'm going to put it to you tonight. Could you, if you're a great big country music fan, could you say the rock and roll? That's kind of an easy one because there's a lot of crossover because there's no such thing as country music anymore. It's just slowed down rock music. Could you do that? Could you relate to a person who likes heavy metal music? I mean, that kind of heavy metal music. Or do you listen to that and you go, oh, how can you listen to that? Well, they like it. That's how they can listen to it. I don't know if it occurred to you. They like it a lot. You're walking down the street with your short sleeves on and your clean arms. Maybe a little light hair here and there. Sun-kissed tone looks really nice. And somebody comes down the road and they've got a ring in their nose, they've got a gauge in their ear, and they got a full sleeve tattoo up their arm. Do you say, hey, I'd like to talk to you for a second about the Bible. Do you have a second? Or when that person's coming down this way, do you go, and if you're with somebody, do you always say, have you seen it? Oh, my goodness. That's a mess. You who are conservative politically, could you save a person who's a wild-eyed liberal? Would you try to teach the gospel to somebody who believes that Roe v. Wade needs to stay in place? Or do you write that person off immediately and just say, they believe in abortion. I can't save that person. You see, sin is bad. And all of it's bad. And it's not just those sins that are bad. Your sins are bad too. And there's an awful lot you used to not know that somebody had to teach you, that God had to show you. There's a lot that you used to be ignorant of. And you've sinned in that ignorance a lot. And once you learned, you put some of those things behind you and you walked away from those things because you learned. But you cannot expect a person who has been living in the world all of their lives with a bad example for parents and with a bad cultural environment, you can't expect them to come in here and know all the right religious words and not say any of the bad words and look like everybody else looks and sound like everybody else sounds. You can't expect that. They need patience, and they need love, and they need help, and they need someone who's got the kind of wrong suffering to bring them on a step at a time. Because you have talked to people who are different than you, you can do that. But if we live in an echo chamber where everybody just says what we say and looks like we look, we find it super difficult to relate to the sinners who are in the world who need Jesus just as bad as you. And it's from taking bad advice that we get to that point. Let me tell you about advice, how very important it is. Everybody needs it. And I'm going to tell you why getting advice is a good idea. It either gives you caution or it confirms what you were planning on doing. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Find somebody else and get some advice from them about what you're planning on doing. If you're old or young, it doesn't really make any difference. Because what you're going to find is that when you ask somebody what they think, what their ideas are, they'll either confirm you're on the right track and you go merrily on your way and you could feel even better about the decision you're making, or they'll give you a caution and they'll make you think about something that you haven't considered before, and it might modify your decision, it might change your decision completely. You may conclude they don't know what they're talking about and you'll go on anyway. That's also possible. And that's why it's so important that you choose carefully who you listen to. The great mistake Rehoboam made here was not even listening to these older people. The book of Proverbs in chapter 16, verse 31, says that the silver head is a crown of glory if it is found in the way of righteousness. Do you know what that means? Being old is a reward. Survival is something God says makes you qualified to give advice. If you're a righteous old person, that means you had a treasure trove of wisdom that must be dispensed. So I'll tell you why most older people don't give advice. And then by give advice, I mean interrupt and interfere in the conversations of young people. They say, well, they just don't want to hear it. You know, I've tried to talk to them, but they just don't want to hear it. Are you explaining why you don't? Or are you just explaining what you already knew? That's the reason you were going to give the advice, because they were not thinking right. Are we waiting for young people to come to us and say, "Oh, wise master, fill my empty head with knowledge"? Is that what we're waiting for? Usually. You know why? It kind of flatters us. It appeals to our ego to be pursued by some young person who says, "Oh, please, Master, tell me what I need to know." But the reality is, in day-to-day life, what it looks like is, you got a kid, you got a grandkid, you got a great-grandkid, and you say, "Whoa, hey, listen to Papa. Now listen to me. Then run the scissors and put your eye out." That's the most basic form of wisdom that gets offered. But still, I mean, still today, that's still valid. Still could happen. But the point is, you know things that kid doesn't know. Whether they're this old and toddling around, or they're this old and playing ball, or they're this old and running for office, you know stuff they don't know. And if it only stays in your head and it dies with you, what does that mean for the next generation? You know what I'm telling you? If you're an older person, you know what I'm telling you? Quit waiting to be asked for your advice and speak up. You've earned the right to be heard. Your hair is the proof that people should be listening to you. Whether it is light or thin or gone, it's the proof that you've hung on long enough to have something worth saying. Let me say the last thing about this, and this lesson will be yours. I told you it'd be a shorter one tonight than the last two. The last two were ridiculously long. Why didn't you stop me? From where you get advice is dreadfully important. Not just age, not just peers, not just... it's very important that you think about the priorities of the people that you're asking. You don't ask broke people for financial advice. Do you? You don't ask divorced people for marriage advice. Do you? You don't ask childless people for child-rearing advice. Do you? Although I've noticed, they seem to know everything. People who don't have kids know everything about raising kids. Anyway. So why would we as Christians, y'all know how to do this little Christian line, man? Y'all know how to do that? One finger, right? Can you do that? Can you hold one finger? I'm not going to ask you to sing a song. Just relax. Hold one finger. Everybody, if you're a Christian, hold one finger. That's how many goals you've really got. That's how many goals there are in your life, really. And you know what that goal is? Get to heaven at all costs, no matter what it takes. So why would people who've got the one goal ask people whose goal that is not for any kind of advice? Of course they're going to tell you to spend your money on carnal things. They are carnally minded people. They're never going to tell you to make a spiritual investment by buying a library of books or by giving it to the church or by funding a mission trip somewhere where the gospel is going to be taught. They're never going to tell you to do that. Of course they're not going to tell you to invest in a marriage retreat or marriage counseling to save your marriage. They're going to say, cut the cord and get out of there with everything you can. They're not going to give good advice. Quit asking your worldly friends for advice. They don't have any good advice. You need to talk to people who've got that one thing. One. You may not get rich listening to them, but you will lay a treasure in heaven. You may not be the most popular person in town, but you'll have the friends that'll be in heaven. You may not have everybody's kids saying, "Those are the cool parents," but your kids will be in heaven. Do one thing determines who you ask to help you in this life. And if you're asking people who you only know in this life, you've asked the wrong people.
and you need to turn it around. And you need to get your kids to turn around. And you need to get your grandkids to turn it around. Because that's the only thing that's going to matter in the long run. And that's what I want to leave with you. I want to go, and I want you to go, and I want to see you there. I want to high-five you at the pearly gates. Again, all that speculation, I don't think any of that's necessarily going to happen. But that's our vernacular. Because I want you to be there. I want to see you. I want to see you smile when you see God. I want to be there and have my back to Him very briefly so I can see your face the first time you see Him. That's what I want. And we'll never get there just messing around playing church. So it's a word to the wise, friends. Source it properly. Use it judiciously. And spend it all right here on the field. Can we have somebody obey the gospel tonight? There may be somebody in our midst who hasn't made the one thing their goal. And if that's the case, we want to encourage you to join us on that road that goes to heaven. Obey the Lord Jesus Christ in your faith. Repent of your sins and confess Him as Lord and put Him on in baptism, and you'll begin the path that leads ultimately in heaven. It may be that you've not been wise about the things that you've done, the decisions you've made. In a crowd of people who you saw holding up that one finger, you admit whatever help you need and they'll give it to you. Can we help you tonight? If there's something we can do, won't you come right now as we stand and sing?